Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Religion, a podcast channel of New Books Network. I'm Dedim Sulongkumar, the host of this channel, and today I'm here with Dr. Swenson to talk about her new book titled A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible.
This is a really interesting book. When I went through this book, I kind of felt that since I come from a Christian culture, and I felt that, okay, I think the information here will be not so much new to me. And since I am a scholar in the area of religion, I might have read so many, I have read so many things in the area of Christianity and the history itself. But I think, surprisingly, this book was something which was very interesting in that sense. And most importantly, for me personally as a scholar, I've always longed to look at work on Bible literature by someone who is outside of the discipline of theology. And I think this book is the book, and I think this book does just justice to the subject itself. So let me come back to the author herself, Dr. Swenson, and let us talk about and dig deep into the book itself. So Dr. Swenson, tell us something about yourself.
Sure. Well, thank you first, Tia, for inviting me to talk with you about this book. It really is always fun to visit with folks who have some interest in the topic. And I really am delighted that you found it to be so engaging and interesting and helpful. I also grew up in a Christian background. I was born and raised in northern Minnesota, which is an area where a lot of Scandinavian Lutherans landed. And so I was raised in a very, what I call a kind of garden variety Protestant background, Lutheran. And I was lucky in that our community really celebrated learning. So I know I came to appreciate sometime later that for some folks, there is some strong suspicion around learning about the Bible, because of some concerns that it might undermine faith. So I feel lucky to have been raised in a community in which those things, learning and faith, went hand in hand. And that is indeed the kind of trajectory I've continued in my studies. As you noted, I do have a PhD in this area, and so I studied it to the nth degree, and I still feel like I'm just beginning to understand and learn. There's so much to know. So I came to religion, actually, a little through the back door, religious studies. I was a biology major in college, but I went to a college, a Lutheran college, where we also had to take some religion classes. And I took a class in the Bible, an introductory to the Bible class. And in that class, I learned about a word play in the very beginning of the Bible, in the book of Genesis. We find in the original Hebrew language a word play that eludes us in a lot of English translations. And that is that in that story of the creation of the human beings that takes place in the Garden of Eden, this is the Adam and Eve creation story, we read in the Hebrew, and I learned this in college and it had me hooked, that that God fashions the human being, Adam, which is often rendered in English translations as Adam with a capital A, but in Hebrew, there's no distinction between capital and lowercase letters. And that word Adam can mean human being in a very generic way, not specific to gender or sex. So Adam was created out of Adama, which in our English translations is soil or land or ground or dirt, and none of which have that that poetic resonance or that wordplay that the Hebrew does. Adam, out of Adama. Human, out of humus, is the closest we might get. Anyway, I've long had an interest and concern, a passion for the non-human natural world and environmental issues inform a lot of my thinking and my way of being in the world. And when I saw that and learned that, this intimate relationship between human beings and the ground, the land, the soil, the earth, the stuff of the world, that this intimate connection between human beings and our world, I thought, wow, there may be a lot more in this book than I'm missing in only reading it in English translation. So although I continued with my biology studies, and I'm grateful for having done that, I loved this. I love the sciences. I also continued to pursue religious studies, and I came to finally learn biblical Hebrew, the language, of course, of the Hebrew Bible, which is basically the Christian Old Testament. And some Greek to learn the New Testament, to read that in its original language, and on and on. My specialty was in the history and literature of ancient Israel. So that is the Hebrew Bible specifically. But in the course of doing that, of course, you learn about culture, you learn history, geography, philology. I got to do some archaeology. So I mean to say, I guess it's just a wonderfully rich area of study, no matter what your beliefs, honestly, just to indulge in the study of these texts is at least one lifetime's endeavor, several, I think, one could use.
And you have also mentioned a little bit in your introduction now, but I also want to ask you, why, again, a book on Bible? I mean, the scholarship on biblical studies is so much. I mean, people are producing so much, writing so much of funding is there, so much of work is there. But why another book on Bible?
That's right. There is so much. There is not, however, a whole lot of information about the Bible without a religious overlay for people to know a little bit about it. That is, there are so many books that sort of unpack the Bible for people of faith, that providing different interpretations or maybe devotional materials, none of which I mean to disparage, but there aren't very many opportunities to learn, for instance, about where the Bible came from, or how the Bible was formed, or about the languages that the Bible was originally written in. And so in my teaching, I've taught for many years in a secular university setting as a university professor at a state school, which means that there's no religious affiliation. And so I taught about the Bible for people who came from all different faiths, and many people who ascribe to no faith at all. And sometimes people would say, how could you do that? How can you teach without interpreting the Bible? And I said, well, listen, you know, what is the first book in the Bible that you would come to when you open the cover? And anyone who's had any experience with the Bible, or if they just picked one up, no matter what their religious belief, would observe that it's this book titled Genesis. And that doesn't matter what you believe. That's still the first book of the Bible. In other words, there are facts about the Bible that sometimes are hard to get because there's so much information about or so much effort that people have made to say what God tells you to do based on what their interpretation of the biblical texts are. This is kind of a long roundabout answer to say that I have been really motivated by giving people the tools to make sense of the text for themselves. So that was especially true of a book I published some years ago called Bible Babble, the subtitle of which is Making Sense of the Most Talked About Book of All Time. And in that, I kind of tried to provide folks with a Bible 101 that was a sort of everything you wanted to know about the Bible, but didn't know enough to ask, like, who is Adam or who is Jonah and where is Israel and why do we care? Things like that. But with this book, I wanted to go a little bit deeper and a little bit farther with some of what people might know or want to know about the text. Namely, that anyone who has dipped into the Bible at all, tried to read it at all, will quickly encounter things that are utterly bewildering. And if not that, then, or I should say, and also, sometimes things that are appalling or off-putting. And nobody really wants to talk about them. There seems to be a sense that especially if you're a person of faith, that would be somehow to undermine the Bible or to call it into question or to somehow diminish its power by noting that, for instance, it disagrees with itself at times. Or there are texts that make us kind of uncomfortable in our chairs that seem to suggest it's a good idea to kill a bunch of people. And so what I wanted to do was give people permission to recognize those things and not just to recognize them and then to say, oh, and so it's all nonsense and we should just get rid of it. But instead to ask, okay, then what do we do with that? What do we do with those uncomfortable things? Or how do we make sense of the stuff that's utterly bewildering? This is an ancient text. You know, it predates us by some of the texts may predate us by a couple of millennia. And so they're already very odd to our ears. They reflect times and places that are very different than our own. But we seldom take the moment to recognize that fact because the Bible is so pervasive. It continues to be so so much a part of people's lives that we are inclined to forget its antiquity and also to try to smooth over those things that make us uncomfortable or seem not to make a lot of sense. So I wanted to just give people an opportunity to recognize those things and honor their observations and also to help them make some sense of them.
That also reflects the line that you have written in your introduction. You have said that this book is an opportunity to step outside assumptions about dogma, traditional interpretations, and received opinions. I think that is something which is very great about this book. And this book, in a sense, as you have said, is a very dense book with 12 chapters, 4 parts. And in this very podcast interview, we cannot really go into all the chapters, but I think there are some important aspects that I want to talk about and where from here on we'll go and dig into the chapter itself, this important aspects that I want to talk about. So you have mentioned this distinction called Bible as literature and Bible as scripture, right? So for someone who is a Christian, a Christian, mostly he or she reads the Bible as a scripture, but then also at the same time, a person who is a Christian, also at the same time a scholar, reads or try to read the Bible in both the sense, as a literature and a scripture, and try to really make sense of it. So, I mean, how do we make this distinction, the Bible as literature and a scripture, and then, you know, how do people, also at the same time, how do we apply these two together in any, in the, our day-to-day life, right? How does it work?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. I think that the distinctions, just as you note, they begin to fall apart a bit the more more closely you engage with the text, because it comes to us as a text. So it is in its form literary. It's a literary text. And one of the ways that we then need to relate to it is as something that's written. So one of the kind of general categories of approach that we can use to better understand it is a literary one. And one of the first questions that we would ask of any text is, what kind of a text is it? Is this a poem? Is it a fable? Is it a story? Is it a law? Is it prophecy? Is it sermonic? Is it an effort to explain how things came to be? An etiologic tale? So that matters, of course, right? Because we would read a legal text differently than we would read a bedtime story, than we would read a poem, or than we would read maybe a prayer. And of course, the Bible includes so many different kinds of literatures. So just recognizing that is, again, a part of recognizing the Bible as literature. And it informs, for people of faith, it can inform how they understand that text to apply to their faith lives. So again, they'll read a legal text differently than they would read an etiologic tale, a story about beginnings or how things come to be. That said, I think that people of faith sometimes will read one of those kinds of texts as thinking that they shouldn't really think any further about it for themselves. That, for instance, let's take Genesis chapter 1, the story of the creation of the world in 7 days. God speaks and the world comes into being. God said, let there be, and there was, right? That's that story of creation. It's a beautiful story. It's one that a number of people of faith have felt they need to accept as a kind of scientific explication of the universe's origins. But if they will look at it again with those literary spectacles, they'll appreciate that it is very formulaic. It is embedded in a larger narrative that matters. But it is likely also, scholars have unpacked a number of the different specific characteristics about it, including its language, to situate its origins in a particular time and place, can come to appreciate that it has import for them as persons of faith, separate from a literalistic application as a scientific description of the universe's origins. That it is a beautiful description of the grandeur of God, the ability of God, to make order out of chaos, and that this world, as God has declared it, creator of it, is good. That is in that story we read, God regularly reflects on God's creation and notes that it is good. That is a different way of reading as a person of faith than the very literalistic reading. This more literary reading as a person of faith, I argue, is more true to the text itself, and it is more true to the reader and the reader's experience. We know that that the world was not created, that the world did not come into being in 7 24-hour days. We know this. And so to try to force our sacred text to conform to some artificial expectation for it is, I think, actually to do our faith a disservice. When we can, as persons of faith, read with those literary spectacles, reading the Bible as literature can enrich our faith. But it may mean we see it differently. I'd like to think a little bit wider,
thinking more broadly. In terms of a broader perspective is something which is really interesting. And I think this is something which people should really think about, right? And really try to maneuver their thinking process through this. Now, coming to the another point where you have said that we don't have the original Bible. Now, I think this statement itself is something which will raise many eyebrows, as you know. And I think, so what do you really mean by this one when you say that we don't have the original Bible? And, you know, what are you getting? I mean, where are you trying to drive this? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to get your head around if you've been raised with this text as God's word. And it's authoritative. It's a discrete body of literature that you identify as authoritative for your sacred tradition. To find that there is no original document that contains all of these and the way that we have them packaged as a Bible today is a bit earth-shattering for me when I learned that. That said, we have, of course, we have fragments of texts that are reflective of our Bibles today. But the Bibles that we use today are, for one thing, multiple. So Protestant Christians have one set of texts, and it's different than Roman Catholic Christians. It's different than the Eastern Orthodox Christians, different than Jews, who have the earliest collection of texts that is part of the Christian Bible, their Hebrew Bible. And that Hebrew Bible is actually different from an ancient translation of it that informs our Christian collections, namely the Septuagint, a Greek translation. So there are actually, when we talk about the Bible, and I do it all the time, we sort of have to use some kind of language, right? We talk about the Bible. It still is important to recognize that my Bible may be different from my neighbor's Bible. That if my neighbor, if I'm a Protestant Christian, my neighbor actually has more stuff in her Bible if she's a Roman Catholic Christian than I do. And that reflects the fact that the Bible developed over a long period of time. It didn't just all fall out of heaven in one moment in the form that we are reading it today. And unless a person is reading ancient Greek and biblical Hebrew and Aramaic, then they're reading a translation. And every translation is interpretation. There is no way around that. And it's not to criticize the translations as somehow lesser than an original. It's just very important to recognize there's no way you can translate a text without making choices as a translator about whether to use one word or a different word, whether to apply a certain syntax or a different syntax to order those words differently. We don't have punctuation in the earliest biblical manuscripts. So where do you put a period? Where do you put the comma? Where is a line break in the case of, for instance, poetic literature, prophetic texts? So it would be great if we had, in a way it would be great, but I'll tell you why I think this is what we have is the best of all the worlds. In a way it would be great, or we seem to assume that there is somewhere one collection of bound pages that is the original Bible that we can all just go back to and look at what the original says. We don't have that. I like that we don't have that because I think that reflects the dynamism of the Bible that we tend to forget better than anything. That is, the Bible grew up over a long period of time. Language is always changing. Our world is always changing. And so we need to use our best selves when we come into relationship with this text, that we are partners in the meaning making when we encounter the biblical text. And because we are, we need to, again, bring our best selves to that project, be the most responsible in terms of our intellect, in terms of our ethics, in terms of our engagement in the greater world. That is, this is one, another reason I wanted to write this particular book was to give people pause from using the Bible to beat up on other people and or engage in activities that are destructive to our greater world. Because I don't think my faith, and I feel so strongly about this, is informed by not doing those kinds of things. And I love this text. And I believe that this text that God, through this text, does not want us to use it to destroy our world or to undermine the integrity of other living things, including other people. So when we encounter these strangenesses in the Bible, the things that make us uncomfortable, the things that make us bewildered and confused, I think those are wonderful opportunities for us to, again, dig down into our best selves and say, okay, what is it that I know I ought to be about in the world? And how does this text challenge me to do that, to think in those ways, to learn as well as I can learn, to be as kind and as generous a person as I can be with an idea and an eye to the greater good. So there you go. That's part of what underlies everything
and,
I do.
As you have explained, understanding the Bible in this way, as you have said, brings out the dynamism of the Bible. But going on, right, you have said that the Word of God is more an ongoing conversation than absolute declaration. Now, for any person, right, coming to a religious text, he or she will always try to find for absolutes for their life in terms of what the text say. I mean, since they believe that that text comes from God as such, something as such. So I think How does we understand this one? So you say that this word of God is an ongoing conversation. So what does ongoing conversation mean? And then conversation, then absolute declaration. So, I mean, what are these, some of these absolute declaration that you want to do away with, right? So I think what do you really kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So there are disagreements within the Bible itself. We find, and it's hard for me to ever get out of the book of Genesis. There's so much there. But in the very beginning, we have two very different creation stories. We have a creation of the world in 7 days, in which God is a disembodied voice who speaks the world into being in a very ordered manner. And it is good. And God rests on that seventh day. That's our Sabbath, right? The Bible, just in our collection of texts, in every Bible that you have, the very next set of texts is a different story of creation. Now, there's no break in the text that we have to indicate that these are two different stories. But again, the Bible grew up over a long period of time. We know that they didn't come to us as books. But these were collected over a period of time, gathered and assembled. The chapter and verse designations that we have in our Bibles today are very late. They come from far closer to the modern period than the ancient texts themselves. So anyway, there's no clear break between these two, but they're very, very different stories. In the creation of the world in 7 days, again, God is an out there deity who just speaks and things happen. In the Garden of Eden story, God is very anthropomorphic. God is very human-like, walks around. God walks. God fashions with God's hands. God breathes into the nostrils of Adam this breath of life. God is a very, looks like a person, a human being for all intents and purposes in that story. Those are very different images of God. And that's before we talk about the creation itself, which again is very different as represented between in those two stories. Are animals created before or after human beings? It's different in those two stories. So we have disagreements within the Bible itself. Now, there are, of course, loads of folks who have recognized those disagreements and have gone to great lengths to explain why they aren't really disagreements at all. But I find that to be preposterous. They are disagreements. And there are other flat-out we have two sets of prophecies, for instance, about one that I just love, I think many do, that appears actually verbatim exactly the same in both the books of Isaiah and of Micah. And it prophesies a time of peace when they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. It's a beautiful passage. And we actually have in our New York City, I believe it is, beautiful statue that was given to us, I want to say, by the Soviet Union. Boy, don't quote me on this, but that is a representation of this time of peace. It's gorgeous. There is also, within the same collection in the Bible, the same in the books of the prophets, we find in the prophet Joel a prophecy telling a time when they shall beat their plowshares into swords and their pruning hooks into spears, literally the opposite of what we have in Micah and Isaiah. Again, people can use all sorts of fancy shenanigans to talk about how those are to be reconciled. But those are just a couple of many, many places in which the collection as a whole contains expressly disparate and disagreeing points. I think, again, that we can talk about the historical context of the Bible's development, that it grew up over a long period of time, a gathering of different kinds of texts. So you're going to have different kinds of texts. I also am a firm believer in the intelligence and informed nature of the persons who collected those texts, that and we can always bring God into all this, like God was present for all of this, or the Spirit moved, and so on and so forth, right? At any rate, I don't think it was random that things were collected as they had been and were put in the placements that we have. Again, that will vary from Bible to Bible. But when you have that, you have an invitation as a reader to recognize these disagreements and to then treat your relationship to the text differently than as a dictatorial, absolutist declaration of God. But instead, maybe God is saying, look, here's an opportunity for you to think for yourself. Here's an opportunity for you to join the conversation. Let's talk about divorce. There are a couple in the Hebrew Bible, a couple of different texts on that matter, if you will, in which in one case, divorce is said to be, you should avoid basically at all cost. And another in which the people of the community are commanded to divorce these significant others. So what do we do with that? I think because we have these disagreeing texts, ancient, we have an opportunity to get into the conversation ourselves and say, okay, we have to think about this for ourselves. And what does this mean? What did it mean back then? Those texts that forbade divorce, we know, were coming from a highly patriarchal culture in which a woman would have been disenfranchised and made tremendously vulnerable by divorce. So to divorce would be a social injustice, an act of social injustice. It's not necessarily that they didn't get along. We're talking about a different set of values and relationship. Recognizing that, we may be more sympathetic to that perspective. Gosh, if a man had all the property and all the power, and he just decides to discard this wife who was by the cultural norms dependent on him for everything, that would have been a grave criminal act on his part. Now, over here, we have this command to divorce. In this case, it is a post-exilic context in which the peoples had been, their numbers had been sorely diminished, and they were at risk of losing their identity entirely. And so you get this moment when the leader of the community says, we cannot have this intermarriage happening right now, because then we'll never exist as a discrete, definable community. So that helps us to make some sense of it, to make some sense of each of those. And then it gives us an opportunity to ask out of our own historical and cultural context, how might we think about those kinds of things? Understanding that there isn't necessarily a dictated answer that God is giving us in the Bible, but instead God is asking us to think for ourselves is what I suggest. I think with these texts, we people of faith have an opportunity to think for ourselves, and that God is asking that of us.
Yes, that's really true. And coming to the text itself, right? And also at the same time, coming to Genesis again, I was really intrigued by your, exposition on Adam and Eve, of the creation, right? God creating Adam and Eve, and, that process of exposition was something which came as a quite something very different to me. And that is where you say that the flute plural singular nature of God anticipates the singular plural nature of human in the story. So what is this fluid plural singular nature of God? And what is the singular plural nature of humans that is portrayed in the Bible? I mean, how do someone understand this?
So in the very beginning of the book of Genesis, we have a name for God that is in its etymology is, its grammar is plural. The word Elohim is a word in Hebrew that can mean gods with a, and strictly it means gods, plural, with an S on the end. And we usually render that, of course, with a lowercase g, a generic noun. But because it is used of the deity, a creator deity here at the beginning of the book, and in Hebrew, the verbs in sentences, you will, the verbs identify the number, person, and gender of the subject. And so when the verb suggests, not suggests, when the verb form is singular, then we know that that Elohim is meant to be a singular deity, though the word itself is plural. So that's one piece of it. But I think probably what I was also talking about in that context is the relationship between Adam and God in those two creation stories. So we talked a little bit earlier about that word Adam and how it is usually written capital A, Adam, as a name. And that doesn't, it's not necessarily wrong. But that word in Hebrew is always lowercase. Well, everything is either all uppercase or all lowercase. There's no distinction between upper and lowercase in Hebrew. And but sometimes a word will have a definite article marker in Hebrew that will indicate it as that we should put up a capital capital letter at the front as a name. But Adam is a very common word in Hebrew, meaning simply human being. It also can mean man, gender specific, as opposed, if you will, to woman. But Adam is, again, super, super common, means human being. We have in Genesis chapter 1 that really intriguing passage of the that describes the creation of the human beings, in which God says, let us create Adam in our image. So we have this plural declaration that God makes in that text. Now, historical context, appreciating historical context, we know that the ancient Near East, out of which these texts came, the cultures there, including the Ugaritic that informed a good bit of what we have in the Hebrew Bible, thought of the heavens, if you will, as populated by deities, plural, who were subject, if you will, to a head god, a sort of chairman of the board. But still, there was a kind of collective effort there. So this may reflect that kind of divine council model where God, in true ancient Near Eastern godly fashion, consults with the other beings, the other divine beings. So let us make in our image. But the text does toggle between the singular and the plural in that story. Now, the ones created in the image of God is Adam. Again, then we have this word that can do all sorts of different kinds of things. It can be human being, it can be man, it can be Adam. But here, it seems very, the best translation is probably of human being, because God then, when you look at this passage, creates Adam simultaneously as male and female. So male and female, God created them. So you have a plural name, a God with a name that's plural, that operates as a singular, that creates Adam, which is a singular noun, but is collective for human beings, creating simultaneously female and male forms of Adam that somehow together are the image of God. So there is a singular, plural, plural, singular business happening in that first creation story. And then when you get to the second creation story, it doesn't completely get cleared up. You have Adam created out of Adama by this much more anthropomorphic God, form of God, who is rather quickly identified by God as having a lack, that Adam is alone. There isn't a partner kind of fit unto this Adam to share Adam's life with. So in that story, it's somewhat humorous. God at that point creates the animals, right? And it's a kind of trial and error effort to find a partner for Adam. God creates the animals and parades them in front of Adam to see if there might be a partner fit for Adam. But alas, there wasn't. But Adam names the animals. Notice how I keep saying Adam instead of Adam, because that's the way the story tells it. This is Adam. And it's only later then, after this somewhat failed experiment, there was no partner fit for Adam from among the animals. Then God anesthetizes Adam, puts Adam to sleep, and performs the surgical procedure, takes from the side of Adam and fashions another. And that is Isha and Ish, woman and man. So it's at that point in the story, and only at that point, that we have the delineation between man and woman. It's only after Adam has been separated out, if you will, into two parts, that we have man and woman expressly and specific, gender-specific language. Now, a biblical person who knows Hebrew reading this will say, yeah, but Adam is all, remember how the verbs identify the number, person, and gender of their subjects? All the verbs associated with Adam were masculine singular. So it doesn't that mean that Adam was Adam? But no, because Hebrew does not have a neuter. It doesn't have a pronoun that is neither male nor female. Like German has a neuter pronoun, right? Hebrew does not have that. Neither does English. We have either masculine or feminine. And whenever there is a collective, Hebrew defaults to the masculine. So it doesn't really answer it. It still is Adam, a clear masculine Adam, until we have that separation of Adam into Isha and Ish, female and male, woman, excuse me, and man, those very gender specific words. So again, you have this this singular plurality happening within Adam and the creation of human beings. And especially again in the first creation story, the creation of the male and female human simultaneously as the image of God is really provocative. You know, it's we tend to think about God in masculine terms. Again, the Hebrew Bible, all of the biblical texts, so the New Testament, of course, comes as later than the texts of the Hebrew Bible, but we're still in a deeply patriarchal culture. And so it shouldn't surprise us that a lot of it focuses on men, that God is predominantly represented with masculine language and imagery. But as persons of faith, we can say, okay, so the Bible does that. We understand its historical context and cultural context out of which it comes. And that doesn't necessarily mean to me as a person of faith that God is a guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is where the kind of fluid nature of who God is and what human beings are meant to be is kind of like overpowered by the cultural norms. And I think that is something which is very important to understand and realize in terms of digging into the text, right? And I think that is something which you have really made clear in your book itself, Anna. That was something really interesting to me. And coming on to the next one, you said that the idea of demons as evil-ish mischief makers that could possess a person with malevolent spiritual forces and cause all sorts of trouble doesn't fit the whole Bible. Now, so how does the Bible portray this demon or evil as?
Yeah, we don't have, so in the New Testament, we have some language of demons.
Yes.
And those possessing spirits. But that is actually a small portion of the entirety of the Bible. We do have references in other biblical texts to beings other than God. But one of the most intriguing is Satan or the Satan, whose evolution we witness within the biblical text. The Satan is, that word is a Hebrew word, is in our modern parlance, Satan with a capital S is the evil alternative of God, is, a devil who presides over hell. Satan is the personification of wrongdoing and evil in our world. But that's actually a very late development. And in the biblical text, somewhat surprising to a lot of people, God actually operates as a Satan. Mm. God sends a Satan as a kind of angel, actually. So, and not a fallen angel, but a messenger of God to do God's bidding. Mm. And Satan is more like a prosecuting attorney in some of the earliest texts. And in most of the Hebrew Bible, Satan is among the divine beings, is one who really sort of ferrets out the truth of a thing. We see the Satan, especially in the book of Job. But then we do find in the New Testament, Satan taking on legs, so to speak, as an alter ego or the evil opposite of God, the tempter. We find the tempter of Jesus in the wilderness. So that whole panoply of bad spirits is an evolution, the product of an evolution of an idea over time.
Yes.
And we see it come in closest to the modern ideas in the New Testament, which has the newest literature.
Yes. And also in line with that one, right? Since my work concerns religious syncretism, and you have also mentioned some of the aspects like marriage, original sin, homosexuality, abortion, and hell, and the examples that you have mentioned, you said that these are some of the, silent issues that are there in the Bible. And also at the same time, the Bible really doesn't say much about these things, but actually we have really, imbued this into the Bible through our culture and the cultural norms that we have. And I think this has so much to do also with the kind of syncretism that is happening around cultures, right? So for me, as I look at Christianity also, I mean, in my work, syncretism is something which is very important. And I think I also see Christianity as a product of the syncretic aspect of the surrounding culture, beliefs and practices and all, right? So do you have something to say on the syncretic aspect of Christianity in that sense?
Well, yeah, sure. The religions of the times reflected, they didn't, you know, come out of nowhere. They didn't develop in a vacuum. And so they inevitably reflect either the things that they were pushing against, those can be some of the strongest, right? Yes. Or the things that they brought with them from religious traditions of their ancestors. To be specific, we find, for instance, a story of Rebecca and the idols that she had, her family's objects that she wanted to bring with her when she and Jacob fled from her uncle's place. And that shows that there was alive and well a practice of valuing objects that were identified in some sacred capacity. And in other places in the texts, we find real effort to distinguish we, the righteous few, from those, the pagan other.
Yeah.
And often when those kinds of things happen, if you peel back the layers a little bit, you discover that the pagan other actually had been us, and we're trying to do something different here. There's one school of thought that rather than, you know, Joshua coming in and killing and getting rid of all of the Canaanites in the land and then establishing, you know, this Israel that was the monotheistic God worshiping, God fearing people, that community of the God-fearing, God-worshiping people actually emerged out of a Canaanite culture that ascribed to worship of Yahweh and possibly a partner, a female consort to a male Yahweh deity, Asherah. We have some archaeological evidence of that. But we get real pushback against those syncretistic impulses in the biblical texts as a way of defining the self over and against the other. Yeah. And of course, Christianity was very much informed by the religions of its time. The Roman traditions were not completely absent from the ways that Christianity developed. Yeah.
And there's so much that seems to, you know, talk about this book. I mean, there's so much that we can really talk about this book. But again, at the same time, there are time constraints and the time, you know, we have certain limited time. So we'll have to come to an end. But I would like to say this about the book. I mean, this book is an invitation to both the believer and the non-believer in a sense of Christian, right? And also at the same time, this book is a critical look at the Bible, but also at the same time, bringing out this dynamism and the beauty in the Bible itself. So I think to the listeners, we have just touched the iceberg here. And I think there's so much to dig in this book. And I think to all the listeners, I would suggest all of you to get hold of this very book and to read it. I think you will thoroughly enjoy this book. Also at the same time, you know, find new ways of trying to understand and trying to read the Bible, because the last chapter is about the 10 commandments for reading the Bible, and the author has taken, you know, Dr. Swenson has taken the blueprint from the 10 commandments itself, and that is something which is really interesting. I think any readers who picks up this book will be really interested by the last chapter also. I mean, that will be like a treat, right? The last chapter will be like a treat, and I think this is something which is very important. I think I these are some of the questions that I've had that I want to explore. There are so many which I want to talk about, but I think we'll have to end the conversation here. So, Dr. Swenson, what is your next project? What are you up to these days? And also at the same time, if anyone wants to reach out to you, what are the platforms where anyone can reach out to you? Any social media or anything? Yeah.
Well, thank you again, Tiat, for this wonderful conversation. It's just so much fun to talk to you about it. And I really appreciate your excitement about this dynamism of the Bible and the invitation to engage with it that clearly has gotten through to you, struck a chord with you, and I really appreciate that. I can be reached. I have a website, kristenswenson.com, and there is a contact page there. It goes to my email, so I do see those, and I love to hear from folks. The book is called A Most Peculiar Book, which was something, A Most Peculiar Book, The Inherent Strangeness of the Bible, which was the suggestion of my editor. And I think it's a really nice title for that subject. It is such a peculiar book, the Bible, and strange and wonderful. And again, I'm glad, Tiat, that you could appreciate that as a Christian and that this is not a book that intends to in any way undermine the power of the Bible, but instead to give folks an opportunity to recognize what's weird about it and try to make some sense of that. My next project, I have a couple things in the works. I've actually been writing some fiction, which is a lot of fun, some set in the ancient world. But I also am working on a project that is an expansion of that final chapter that you were talking about, Tia, 10 Commandments for Reading the Bible. So that's in the works as well, and we'll see where it goes. In the meantime, it's just wonderful to visit with you, and I wish you well in your studies as well.
Yes, very, very exciting things ahead of you, and thank you so much for joining me, and take care. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Tia.